It's time for the December edition of Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. And in the hour ahead, we'll discuss two important environmental stories. How two Democratic governors, Martin O'Malley in Maryland and Andrew Cuomo in New York, take vastly different approaches to the controversial drilling process known as fracking for natural gas. Cuomo yesterday announced a statewide ban on fracking in New York. O'Malley wants to allow it in Western Maryland and regulate it. We'll also look at how two Maryland governors, the outgoing O'Malley and the incoming Larry Hogan, take vastly different approaches to curtailing pollution from Eastern Shore chicken farms. Plus, Rona reports on a Chesapeake Bay poaching case. Midday on the Bay, after the news from NPR. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. It's time for Midday on the Bay with Chesapeake Bay Journal reporter Rona Cabell, back with us for the December edition of our show on the environment. Rona, nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
This is going to be a busy hour. We have a lot to talk about, including a federal judge coming down really hard on a Chesapeake Bay rockfish thief, a story that Rona's working on today for the Chesapeake Bay Journal, or is already finished, right?
Yes, I'm just waiting for my editors to put it up online.
Okay, in case they're listening, yeah.
Yes.
The reporter has filed the story, but we'll talk about it later in the hour to fill folks in on that, because that's quite a penalty that came out of federal court on this. Also, big news out of New York, the governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, calling for a ban on fracking in New York. That's the Cuomo approach. In Maryland, the O'Malley approach has been to, after a three-year study on fracking for natural gas, to say, well, we're going to allow it in the western part of the state, but we're going to regulate it very carefully. And we'll talk about that in this hour as well. But off the top, Rona, we're going to speak with Eric Schaefer. Eric Schaefer is executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project, a nonprofit based in Washington that's dedicated to the enforcement of environmental laws. And we have Eric on the show because of a report his organization put out last week, a bit overshadowed by the news that the governor-elect in Maryland, Larry Hogan, has promised poultry farmers in Maryland that he is going to scrap new rules that were put in place regarding phosphorus pollution, specifically that kind of pollution from poultry farms, that the new governor is going to scrap the rules put in place only a few weeks ago by the previous governor. So we welcome Eric Schaefer to Midday on the Bay to join us to talk about that report. Eric, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Dan. Hi, Rona.
Hi.
So let's start with, first, Eric, take your time here and explain to our listeners what exactly you set out to do in studying these annual reports from farmers in Maryland.
Okay, I know you both understand this well already, but maybe I should start with a problem, which is phosphorus. And that is one of the major pollutants in the Bay watershed. It's a big problem because it feeds algae blooms, it sucks oxygen out of the water, and it's one of the pollutants most responsible for the dead zones that you keep reading about, where no fish can survive or breed. So it's a big issue for the Bay. Agriculture contributes more than half the phosphorus load that ends up in Bay waters, and that's true in Maryland, and it's also true across the Bay watershed, including other states. So agriculture is one of the major sources of phosphorus, and it gets into the Bay because farmers put fertilizer on crops, which of course they need to do, but if you overload crops with fertilizer, you end up with too much phosphorus in the soil, and that just means it's going to wash off and get in the water, which is a bad thing. Now, on the Eastern Shore, we've got, of course, we're famous for our poultry industry. That's more than 300 million birds a year that farmers raise under contract with Purdue and other big companies, but it also means about 1 billion pounds of manure every year. It's got to go somewhere, and right now where it goes is on the land in the Eastern Shore. What we did is look at reports that poultry operators who spread poultry waste on their own crops file with the state, and we found, based on their reports, that they are applying in the aggregate, in total, three times the amount of phosphorus, that's the phosphorus in the manure, three times the amount of phosphorus that's needed for healthy plant growth. And that's based on a criteria that the Maryland agricultural department puts out. You know, how much corn needs, how much soybeans need. They can only take up so much phosphorus, and the load reported from these farms that's being put on the soil is three times more than the plants actually need. It's being added to soils that are already saturated with phosphorus, which is a big problem, because what that means is at the end of the harvest cycle, after you've taken the crops up, you've applied the waste, you've taken the crops up, you end up with even higher phosphorus concentrations in soils that already have too much. That means you're going to get runoff, and we have a lot to do to get that problem fixed.
What I found impressive in this is these reports are from the farmers themselves, right, Rona? This is something we haven't seen before.
Right. So,
Not
to the extent that the Eric's group analyzed it. And part of the issue, Eric, please correct me if I'm wrong, is that the poultry farms are CAFOs, and they're required to concentrated animal feeding operations. They're regulated by the EPA and MDE. They're large animal operations. Everybody's required to file a nutrient management report. But the CAFOs, their reports are public. And so Eric was able to look at the poultry farmers and what was happening with the manure that they were producing and where it was going. It is excellent work, but I think it is also just a fraction of the picture there is other information that is not available to the public, that was not available to be analyzed about, you know, to get an idea of all of the manure that's on the Eastern Shore. Am I saying that right?
No, I can quickly respond, Rona. That's exactly right. In fact, even among the large, you call them CAFOs, the big poultry operators that have to report, you report specific data on how much phosphorus is in your soil and how much you're adding if you spread manure on your own land. If you ship it to the farm next door or 1 mile down the road, that information is not available to the public. What most of the poultry operators do is they ship it off-site. It doesn't go very far. That's one thing we were confirmed. The manure is all staying on the Eastern Shore. But we have a set of data from 63 farms that report spreading it on their own land. And I would, I'm doing this from memory, about 80% of the total is sent off-site, and that's where we don't have the data. And that's just for the big poultry operators.
All right. Let me ask you this, Eric and Rona. What did the O'Malley administration propose just a few weeks ago in terms of curtailing phosphorus runoff into the bay? I'll start with Rona on it. What exactly did they say they wanted farmers to do?
Well, they proposed a phosphorus management tool, which is not new. They've sort of just refined what they had in the past. And what they did was they said they looked into a whole bunch of different values. If you have slopes, what kind of farm you have, if close to the water, how far it is from the water, how much poultry had been applied in the past, what was the soil test result.
How much manure had been applied in the past.
Manure. And they assigned you a value. And if your value was over 150 of all these different criteria, then you could apply no more phosphorus. And according to the University of Maryland's research, about half the farms on the Eastern Shore fit this no more phosphorus category. And that's when a couple of years ago we had this uproar because they realized that this was going to really mean a huge change to the Eastern Shore.
Eric, do you want to add to that?
That's very accurate. We found, just for context, those Maryland numbers were about right. 43% of the total phosphorus in the manure that we got reports on, 43% of that was applied to soils with that over 150 value. And just to, you know, explain it, those are soils that are super saturated in phosphorus.
Right.
They already are, you know, the concentrations are already not just excessive, but way excessive.
Okay. So now we have a governor-elect who says, well, these rules have come in at the last minute. The O'Malley administration put them in, I think it was in November, right?
Right.
Delayed 2.5-3 years, I think. They've been talking about these rules. And I'm not going to let it happen. Larry Hogan tells farmers that this would decimate the poultry industry on the Eastern Shore. In what way does it would it decimate the poultry industry? That's what I'm trying to get at. So, Eric, what's their argument there? It's costly to take the manure elsewhere?
You would have to take the manure elsewhere. Not all of it, but some of it. I'd like to flip the issue around and state the problem. We've got lots and lots of manure going on land that already has way too much, and what that means is every year those phosphorus concentrations get higher. We just can't keep doing that forever, and the phosphorus management tool is a way to do that. The cost, if you look at the estimates, it's about $22 million, and the benefits are $100 million in terms of improvement in water quality. That comes out of a Salisbury University study. And if you think of it as cost per chicken, it's 5 or 6 cents per bird. That's what accomplishing this would cost, and that could be used to help farmers find alternate uses for the manure. We've just got to stop piling it on land that already has too much.
I was speaking a few weeks ago with a scientist who sat on a commission that was appointed by the governor some years ago to look into an environmental matter, and this was one of the issues they looked into: phosphorus and nitrogen runoff from poultry farms. And he said, if you just add a nickel to the cost of a chicken, you could raise enough money to haul a lot of this away, the excess, what is not needed, away. And phosphorus probably can be used other places in the country by farmers elsewhere. But it would just, people would need to pay a little bit more for a chicken. And, chicken is still, relative to other meats, still a pretty good buy in the supermarket. Rona, I asked you about this. I said, why not just pay a little bit more for chicken?
Well, that didn't go anywhere, did it?
they had a proposal like this in the legislature, right?
Right. That has kind of been a non-starter. And just to sort of reiterate what you were saying and what Eric was saying, this has been 2 or 3 years in the making under the O'Malley administration, but I've been writing about it since 2007, and it predated me by a few years that scientists have been struggling and working on this phosphorus issue. And I know way too much about how manure works, so I'll just say this, that one of the problems is that when you apply poultry manure to a crop, the crop takes up the nitrogen very thirstily, but the phosphorus, not so much. And so you apply for the nitrogen needs, and the phosphorus comes along for the ride. So what the $22 million that Eric was speaking about that was in the Salisbury University study, a large amount of that money would be going to the use of commercial fertilizer instead of manure. And with commercial fertilizer, you get the fertilizer mixed and in many cases applied for you. So if you don't need the phosphorus, you don't get the phosphorus.
Mm-hmm. I get it. Eric, there's one important thing I want to ask you about here. Given what the Environmental Integrity Project came up with here, and just reviewing records that are submitted to the state in 2012, I believe this was for, is there an issue of enforcement here that's not being met? Is the state not assessing these records in the same way you are and saying to farmers, you're putting too much phosphorus into your soil, three times as much?
That's an excellent question. One of the things we did find is that there was a fair amount of non-reporting. And the first obligation is to where you are required to submit these reports. And I'm talking here about farmers who put it on, poultry operators rather, who put the manure on their own land. You're supposed to report. We found a substantial number either hadn't reported or had incomplete reports. And since July, my understanding is Maryland sent out more than 100 notices of violation for failure to report. So that's a good thing. They are moving to get the reports complete. I think one of the problems with the current regulations is, once you've filed your report and you have a nutrient management plan, you've got what we used to call narrative requirements, which, it's a lot of paragraphs, but it's kind of hard to get to what's the bottom line that you have to do. There are some work practices, you can't spread it on frozen fields, and that helps. But what we really need is to keep this phosphorus off the hot spots where the soil already is buried in phosphorus. That's what the new regulations would do.
Eric Schaefer is the executive director of the Environmental Integrity Project. We're talking about the EIP's study of these records from farmers on on the amount of phosphorus that's going into the soil in the Eastern Shore. We'll post that report on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page, and along with the posting of today's show on the midday on the WYPR website as well. Eric, thank you for spending this time with us.
Thanks for having me.
We'll come back and talk some more about this with Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal. We'll also talk about fracking, the announcement by Governor Cuomo in New York yesterday to ban fracking in that state, what the O'Malley administration has in mind for hydrofracturing for natural gas in western Maryland, and this big rockfish poaching case in federal court. Rona will report on that as well. We can take some phone calls with questions about all this. 410-662-8780. What do you think about spending another nickel for a chicken to have a cleaner Chesapeake Bay? An email from Ellen in Baltimore says, a while back I saw bags of chicken droppings for sale as garden fertilizer at a pretty steep price. Isn't there a market for this stuff where the chicken farmers would be paid and someone would cart it off? Rona Cabell with me here, Dan Roderick's on Midday on the Bay. I talked to our friend, colleague Tom Horton about this a week or so ago, and he told me about a possible phosphorus fertilizer shortage in the future because there's only so much phosphorus that can be mined, and this might be another source for fertilizer in the future, and that we ought to be stockpiling perhaps phosphorus someplace where it won't damage anything. I haven't had a chance to look into all that, but that's what Tom was suggesting. We explore that.
Right. Researchers call it the phosphorus paradox because there is a shortage of phosphorus in the world, and it's one of the few resources that's not renewable. You have to mine it from pits, and once you're out, that's it. So we have too much. Other places don't have enough. And the challenge is to take the phosphorus and put it in some sort of a useful form. And the Department of Agriculture is looking into something like that, into sort of a phosphorus sequestration plant. In terms of the additives to chicken manure, Purdue has this plant called the Purdue AgriCycle plant in Delaware. And what it does is it takes about 10% of all the manure on the Eastern Shore and pelletizes it and puts that additive into a fertilizer that you can buy.
10%.
10%. They would like more, but they've only been able to get 10%.
Now, Purdue was also in the running, I think, to be involved in the development of a chicken manure to electricity power plant, right?
Right.
Let's tell folks about this a little bit. I touched on it in my column recently, or column last week, last Sunday, I think it was. I can't remember when that column ran. I think it was Sunday. But anyway, a few years ago, we had this agreement between the state of Maryland and Exelon Corporation over the purchase of Constellation Energy by Exelon, the energy giant. And part of that agreement was, I think, something like $75 to $80 million for the development of a waste-to-energy power plant somewhere on the Eastern Shore to handle this animal waste, the chicken manure. And that hasn't gone anywhere. That's in the state of limbo still. As Martin O'Malley leaves office, that thing has not been developed. The money is available for it. There's a company from California, I think it is, that's supposed to be developing it. But I haven't been able to get an answer to my question, where does that stand these days, either from that company or from the Maryland Energy Administration? What do you know about it, Rona?
Well, I've looked into it a little bit as well, and I haven't really gotten much either. What I know is that this company called Green Planet Power Solutions out of California, which had never developed a manure-to-energy plant before, put in the lowest bid, and they were awarded the contract. Purdue and Fiberwatt put in a proposal together.
That's a British company, right?
Fiberwatt. Fiberwatt is a company that is, they have a turkey manure-to-energy plant out in Minnesota. So they've done one project. They have several other projects on the books. I've interviewed them a couple of times. They seem very knowledgeable about the process of turning manure into energy. In the beginning, they did have some air quality violations in Minnesota. I think those are under control, but environmentalists are still very concerned about what happens to the air when you burn this poultry.
I understand. There's a related issue to
right,
that.
Right. But casting that aside, they were people who probably could have gotten this plant built, given that Purdue knows manure and Fiberwatt knows manure to energy. They could have probably gotten something going, but they didn't get the bid. This other company got the bid, and they haven't really been able to do much. They had a site in Federalsburg. That didn't work out. They were talking about another site. You know, it's very disappointing because it really was an opportunity with this chunk of money from Exelon to do something.
And this settlement with Exelon was 3 years ago.
Yes.
So that's really a shame that this thing has not gotten running up and running yet. And supposedly, this waste-to-energy plant could keep hundreds of thousands of tons of excess chicken manure and this phosphorus that Eric Schaefer was talking about out of the ground, and you could turn it into electricity.
And while Maryland has stalled on this with the big state budget and all these other things, I know a couple of farmers in Pennsylvania in these past 3 years that have built manure digesters on their own and managed to make a profit and sell the gas that they make from their digester back to the public. Now, this is cow manure, so it's a little different, and poultry manure is dry, and that has its own complications. But it is possible to do it. And to do it without $75 million.
Let's take a phone call. We welcome calls during this hour of Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wypr.org. Craig's in Baltimore with a question for us. Hi, Craig.
Hi. My concern is that O'Malley did this by executive fiat in the waning days of his term, instead of properly letting the legislature work on it. Now, and have the environmentalists taken the legislature to task for raiding the Chesapeake Bay Fund? I used to be pretty well acquainted with Tom Horton years ago when he was starting all this, when his wife was still alive and all. And I don't hear much criticism of the Democrats in the state, in the legislature, and the governor's mansion that have been raiding the Chesapeake Bay Fund all along, when it should, all that was collected should have been going to, funding processing plants, breakdown plants, scrubbers. You know, if they're going to burn it, you know, scrubbing off what gas is out.
Okay, Rona.
Well, let me try to explain how the phosphorus thing got started and how it works. For a very long time, about 25, 26 years, there have been a lot of voluntary measures to clean up the Chesapeake Bay. Around 2008, it was very clear that these weren't working, and so we got something called the pollution diet. Under the pollution diet, we have to restrict our nitrogen and phosphorus by various sectors in various places by various limits. Phosphorus is one chemical that we really have to restrict, and we have limits on the Eastern Shore. So the EPA told Maryland, you've got to restrict your phosphorus. And O'Malley and his Department of Agriculture decided that the best way to reduce the phosphorus was to use this tool, which had been in implementation for quite some time already. So I'm not really sure that you want your legislature dealing with limits on phosphorus. The EPA already said you need to do this. And we did get last session, we did get Senator Mathias and Delegate Norm Conway putting restrictions on the Department of Agriculture's ability to implement this tool. And that's one of the reasons for the delay. They required by legislation that there be a study and that it be conducted by Salisbury University and that
the Purdue Business School,
right,
or something, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, they didn't. I don't know that they required it be done by Salisbury,
okay,
but
that's who did it.
That's who did it. There were yeah, very few bidders on this, yeah, on this study. I think
it's not unusual for the Department of Agriculture to promulgate rules.
No, it's not, and especially a rule like this, which should arguably be based on solid science and not based on politics.
What is Craig's referring to the Chesapeake Bay Fund?
Would that be the
I don't know what he's gone now. I'm not sure what he's talking
there's
about.
There's a few different Chesapeake Bay funds. There's, yeah, the one that's doing the flush tax. There's other funds, but the $22 million that would be needed to cover the phosphorus index, that would be money that the state, maybe through the USDA and other partners, would help farmers get. So,
Craig, what are you talking about? Craig is still there.
Am I still there?
Yes. What are you talking about? The Chesapeake Bay Fund.
Well, and what's been collected from the flush tax, rain tax, checkoff, you know, the license tags, all of that. I thought that was all one fund.
No, it's not one fund. It's several different funds you're talking about. The rain tax is not one fund. The flush fee, that is going directly to fix up sewage treatment plants. There's a fraction of that that's going to septics and cover crops. I don't think any of that is designated specifically for phosphorus. And the rain tax is not, there's no such thing really as the rain tax, but the stormwater management fee is collected by different counties, and that money is supposed to be, and in some cases statutorily required, to be focused on stormwater improvements, green infrastructure, fixing storm drains, that kind of thing. So
I hope Craig was listening when we questioned, and I was criticizing O'Malley administration for missing an opportunity on the waste to energy plant. That money's there. That's Exelon money.
Right.
I believe it's $75 million, and that has not been fully utilized yet. And we don't know what's going on with that company in California and the Maryland Energy Administration. Governor Andrew Cuomo in New York, his administration announced yesterday that it would ban hydraulic fracturing, better known as fracking, in New York State because of concerns over health risks. And this ends years of debate over that method of extracting natural gas from the Marcellus Shale, as it's known. Maryland has a little piece of the Marcellus Shale out in western Maryland, Garrett County and Allegheny County. And we've been studying this thing in Maryland for a number of years as well during the O'Malley administration. Here's Rona on fracking.
Well, this is pretty significant, Dan. New York is the first state other than Vermont, which has a negligible amount of shale, that that banned the practice of fracking. We have had municipalities and counties in New York that have banned it, and some counties and cities in Texas that have banned it. But this is the first time that a state banned it. They already had a moratorium in place while they were undergoing the study. One of the main impetuses for taking up the study is the New York City drinking water. The wells for New York City, right, the supply, comes from upstate and overlaps with the Marcellus Shale. And people were extremely concerned in New York City that this could contaminate the water supply. So you had, whereas in a lot of places, the fracking question or debate affects rural residents who might not have as much power or as much voice. In New York City, it affected the people who were extremely powerful and extremely vocal. And there were a lot of demonstrations, and there was a lot of cheering on the environmentalist side that the governor had made this decision.
And on the other side, people are saying, well, you know, these are depressed areas of New York State and Pennsylvania that could use some economic uplift and create jobs. And it's a shame that this is happening. Of course, it is happening in Pennsylvania, but it won't be happening in New York State.
Right, right. And it's slowing down because of the price drop. It's fracking is slowing down all over the place. So the decision isn't as big a deal as it might have been a couple of years ago. But it's still pretty significant that Governor Cuomo took this action. And when you compare it to what O'Malley did, it's really quite different. O'Malley said that after our study, he believed that it could still be done safely with all these restrictions, whereas Governor Cuomo said we had a lot of these restrictions in place and the risks were still too great.
The New York Times story says the move by Cuomo to ban fracking left him acknowledging that despite the intense focus he has given to solving deep economic troubles afflicting large areas upstate, the riddle remained largely unsolved. Quote, I've never had anyone say to me, I believe fracking is great, he said. Not a single person in those communities. What I get is I have no alternative but fracking. So that's the story in New York State. You can comment on that. Give us a ring if you like this hour as we discuss this with Rona. So back to the O'Malley administration. So we studied it for 3 years, and the O'Malley administration said, yes, allow it, but we will have the safest regulations in place for the safe extraction of natural gas from the Marcellus Shale in Allegheny and in Garrett County. And one thing I want to note here, the administration concluded that there is, quote, no doubt that fracking has the potential to harm public health, the environment, and natural resources. But if strict safeguards are imposed and enforced, the administration says problems, quote, can be managed to an acceptable level. I don't know how that sounds to you, Rona, or our listeners. I'd be curious what your reaction is to that phrasing. That sounds like a no to me, okay, personally. 410-662-8780 is our number. 410-662-8780. Now, sure, it will create jobs maybe in Western Maryland. I don't know what the estimate is here, but I'll look it up. But there's all that great natural, that great natural setting in Western Maryland, rivers and mountains, and is that what we want in this state? So anyway, Rona.
Well,
I guess I should ask you, are you surprised by the recommendation that came out of the O'Malley administration, first of all?
Not really. And one reason why is there are a lot of fears that if you ban it entirely, there will be lawsuits and you'll be tied up in court and be spending state resources on fighting the gas companies. I'm also not surprised because there were some leases out in Garrett County and some influential landowners really wanted to see this happen. But back to the it can be done safely. This is an argument we hear from a lot of the drillers. And when something goes wrong in fracking, there's often multiple culprits on multiple occasions. Sometimes it's a well casing that wasn't situated properly. Sometimes it's concrete that wasn't reinforced properly. Sometimes it's a truck that wasn't properly safeguarded so that it spilled. So there's a million things that can go wrong.
You should mention that in the process of hydrofracturing, the water is used and there's wastewater that sometimes has to be trucked away, right?
Right. And the Maryland requirements require that, you know, when possible, that water be recycled. And so you have this, they call it processed water. It's the water goes down into, they withdraw water from the stream. The water goes down into the rock. It loosens up the gas. You take the gas out, and then you have this waste water that comes back up. That's what they call processed water. But it's water with not only the fracking fluid that they put in to lubricate the rock, but the other stuff that's in the rock that we prefer to keep underground, things like radium that we don't really want out and about. So that stuff comes back up. And then what they were doing in Pennsylvania was they were taking that waste and they were sending it to the sewage treatment plant. And the sewage treatment plant was giving it the sort of regular tertiary treatment and then releasing it into waterways. And you were seeing fish kills and all kinds of problems. So then Pennsylvania said, OK, we're not doing that anymore. Ohio said, we'll take your waste and we'll inject it underground. And so what happened in Ohio? There were earthquakes. So my point is that there are many, many different variables and many different things that can go wrong and many different vectors by which different pollutants, processed water, fracking fluid, can get into drinking water, groundwater, farm ponds. There are all kinds of issues with it. So can it be done safely? Anything can be done safely, theoretically, and anything can also not be done safely, theoretically.
This is a quote from Drew Cobbs, executive director of the Maryland Petroleum Council. He suggested, and this is a story in the Baltimore Sun, if Maryland's regulations are much more stringent than those of neighboring states, it could discourage gas companies from drilling in Garrett or Allegheny counties. So, let's not set the bar too high or else we'll lose the opportunity to draw natural gas out of the ground here in Maryland. I'd like to hear from our listeners out there. 410-662-8780. Here's a couple of emails that came in. Why don't I save these for after the break, Rona? More with Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, posting a story today about that poacher who went to federal court and got slammed by a judge yesterday. We're going to talk about that as well when we get back. This is Midday on the Bay. My able assistant is posting as we speak Rona's story from the Chesapeake Bay Journal on the rockfish poacher who got slammed in federal court. More on that in just a moment. Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell from the Bay Journal. Herman in Waverly. Welcome,
hey,
welcome to the show. Hi.
How you doing?
Good.
Listen, on my quarterly water bill from the city of Baltimore, there's a $15 Maryland stormwater fee. And I gather that there are 2 million users on the city of Baltimore water system. If you multiply that by 2 million times four quarters, that's $120 million a year being collected by somebody called Maryland Stormwater Fee. I've seen no accounting for this.
Okay, you have a question about the accounting for the use of that money, stormwater fee money, Rona.
When this was first debated, Baltimore City said they were going to use the original money that they had been spending on stormwater and use that to relieve property taxes, I believe, and they were going to take stormwater management money and spend that in stormwater. Some counties have a restriction that you must use any money that you collect on stormwater for stormwater purposes. I am not entirely familiar with what Herman is talking about, but I did want to say one thing about communities and stormwater. I have really been excited to talk to some people in different places around the state who are not required to do a stormwater management fee or did it before they were required. And in particular, this community called Highland Beach, where I was a couple months ago, way before anyone really started talking about mandating this, they were proactive. They got grant money. They have a green town hall. They have a community full of beautiful rain gardens. Their mayor, Bill Sanders, and his wife, Zora Lathan, have made this a cause. They've taken it on. And as a result, other communities are going to Highland Beach and asking, how can we do what you've done? Because their community, frankly, looks beautiful. And it stands out among communities in Anne Arundel County because it's so green and so lush. And it also is a very historic, important community. It was the community that Frederick Douglass's son founded because he wasn't allowed on the white beaches. So he decided to buy this community and build it so that African Americans could have a place to go to the beach. So there's a historic imperative to make the community beautiful and keep it that way.
Did they receive a grant that came from stormwater fee collections?
No, they went out on their own and got grants from different states and counties and different places.
See, what Herman's wondering about is when are we going to see an accounting for the money collected, say, in Baltimore City where he is, Baltimore County? I know Baltimore County is spending some of their stormwater fee revenue on street sweepers, as is Baltimore City. I mentioned that in my column the other day. But there needs to, he's right. There needs to be a fuller accounting of how is this being spent, what's it being spent on, and is it helping?
I think that's a really good story idea. I'm going to file that one away.
Thank you, Herman.
That was good.
Here's an email from Joan in Annapolis. She says, I'd be happy to pay a bit more for chicken to improve our waterways, but two questions. Do crops suffer because of too much phosphorus in the soil? That's a good question. How do the benefits of a healthier bay and rivers from Maryland watermen come into play as opposed to objections from farmers about the new guidelines? On that latter point, I just want to say this. In my column on Sunday about Larry Hogan and the chicken manure and what to do about it, some people wrote in. I think one of these letters was published in The Sun saying I kind of missed the point that there's a greater economy out there. Larry Hogan can call himself pro-business, and that's why he's opposing these extra rules on poultry farmers. But what about everybody else who makes a living related to the Chesapeake Bay? Don't you want a cleaner bay for them?
And there is a big cost. And you hear sometimes people will say on the Eastern Shore, oh, the chicken manure, it's good for the oysters. The oysters eat pollution. Yes, they do. But there is such a thing as too much. And there is such a thing as an overindulgence, if you will, on the buffet of pollution that is choking not only oysters, but habitat for crabs, grasses, oyster reefs, other things. So, yes, absolutely. You made a really good point, Dan, that there. What about the rest of us? There is more.
No, I missed the point, according to readers. I appreciate them writing in to say that.
But you made it now.
I only have 840 words at a time. Okay. And do crops suffer because of too much phosphorus in the soil?
I don't think so.
Yeah. It's just superfluous.
It's the waterway.
Right? Yeah.
I mean, what they don't take up goes down into the groundwater and runs off.
Yeah. Kim in Howard County, thank you for joining us on Midday on the Bay.
Hi. I was just wondering on O'Malley's guidelines on or regulations or whatever they are for fracking. Is there a clause in there for that will allow Marylanders who are harmed by fracking to sue for damages?
Yeah, I think you always have that option. You mean if you live nearby and you actually can prove that you were damaged by something related to the hydrofracking? Is that what you mean?
Right. Well, yeah. Under federal guidelines, companies are immune from any suits and for any damages to the water or to the land or whatever. And so the question is will Maryland be imposing a right to sue?
I'm not sure what to say there.
There's
federal immunity from the clean, not from the Clean Water Act.
Not from the Clean Water Act. What you may be thinking of is, if you sign a lease with a gas company, you may forfeit your right to litigation under that lease. But where it gets complicated is if we're neighbors and you sign a lease and I don't, and I'm damaged, and then you're damaged, how does that work out? So there are a lot of complications. But you know, many communities have sued the gas companies, and some of that litigation is still going through the courts.
John in Baltimore City with a comment or question. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi.
I just recently completed a coast-to-coast trip. I drove from Baltimore City all the way to L.A. and back. And, you know, particularly through Texas and New Mexico, I saw areas that fracking was taking place, and they've kind of been able to do whatever they want without very much regulation at all. And I see in a lot of communities that it becomes kind of the primary industry of those areas, and it kind of squeezes out other things from happening, particularly in Carlsbad, New Mexico. You could see this as every single truck had a drill sticker on the side, and the whole industry of the entire city was, you know, kind of like knocked down to specifically having to do with fracking.
Okay. Thank you for that comment. I don't know what to add to that. It remains to be seen whether this is going to happen in Maryland.
Right.
It really
does.
What about Hogan? We haven't mentioned him in fracking. So he has said that he's tired of it being studied. It's time to act.
Right.
Has he said anything more than that?
No, and we don't know what act exactly means. I mean, is he going to be opening up state forest land to drilling? Is he just going to be allowing people to engage in leases if they wish to? We don't really know. There's so many unknowns right now about Larry Hogan. I think we're just going to have to wait and see what happens when he takes office.
Rona, here's a comment from David in Towson about fracking. Kudos to Governor Cuomo of New York for banning fracking. Fracking is questionable at best. Ignoring the pollution risk, let's remember that fracking sites are heavy industry sites with hundreds of trucks coming and going, industrial, loud noise, lighting at all hours of the day and night. Do we want this for Western Maryland, a tourist destination? Let's ask the people in the Gulf of Mexico or near the Exxon Valdez spill in Alaska about how regulations protected their environments. Technology is always claimed to be safe until it is not. Maryland should follow New York's wise decision, says David. A Tillman Island fisherman was sentenced to a year and a day in prison, but that's not the half of it. William Lednum, who was accused of, I guess, pleaded guilty to stealing rockfish out of the bay, poaching, illegal harvest of rockfish, $40,000 fine, as well as $498,293 in restitution to the state of Maryland. Rona, tell us about William Lednum, Bill Lednum.
Well, this happened yesterday in federal court. William Lednum and his co-defendant, Michael Hayden, together are responsible for that almost $500,000 fine. Hayden was supposed to be sentenced yesterday, too, but his sentence has been postponed. So what happened was over 4 years, these guys had illegal nets set up in the Chesapeake Bay, and they took the fish, and they didn't the fish were unmarked, uncounted. So they came out of the bay without the Department of Natural Resources knowing it. They had the gill nets out when everybody else was told they couldn't have gill nets when the season was not on. And they bypassed fish checking stations and wholesalers and other ways that the DNR would have records of the fish. And the reason that this is important is because, other than the fact that it's stealing a public resource, is that the Department of Natural Resources, every year they figure out how many rockfish are in the bay and what to do to keep the population healthy, which is important not just for the Chesapeake, but for the entire coast.
It's called managing the resource.
Right. And you remember the rockfish moratorium of 1985-1990. That was done in response to credible information that there was a shortage of fish, and the moratorium was put in place, and the fish rebounded. So having accurate information on how the fish is doing is important, not just to those of us who like to eat rockfish and those of us who like to catch rockfish, but to the rest of the entire state of Maryland, everybody, you know, all the different resources in the bay, all the entire food chain, et cetera. So stealing fish is one thing, but taking fish out of the system and never having a record of them at all is even more significant.
Especially on this scale, 185,000 pounds of striped bass or rockfish.
Right.
I remember when you were here a few years ago, and this had just happened.
Right.
The Maryland Department of Natural Resources and the DNR police found these anchored nets. Remember these? The nets were anchored to the bottom, right?
Oh, yeah.
And they were all these rockfish in them.
There were
and
so many.
We didn't know who was responsible at the time.
There were so many that they had an icebreaker, and it couldn't even lift the nets. They were full of dead rockfish. And they had to close down the gill season for a couple of weeks, I think it was, so that they could deal with this problem. So law-abiding watermen lost much of their income while this was being investigated.
This is a violation of the Lacey, what is it? The Lacey Act, a federal law that protects fish and wildlife. So Lednum and Hayden went to federal court. Let's see. No, I'm sorry. Lednum was in federal court by himself.
Yes.
So $40,000, $498,000 in restitution, and a year and a day in prison. I mean, that's a slam. How significant is that compared to other penalties you've seen?
It's pretty significant. Now, there was a poaching case a couple years ago that was the largest poaching case in the Chesapeake Bay, and the two of the people involved in that case did get jail time. I think one guy got 17 months and another guy got 21 months. But jail time for fishing violations is still relatively rare. And the judge in this case clearly took no pleasure in sentencing this man to jail. Mr. Lednum is a volunteer fire chief in Tillman Island. He's a father. He's a husband. He's a man who clearly felt remorse over what he did. But it's a significant violation. And the judge said several times, I need to send a message from this court. I need to send a message from this bench. If I don't send you to prison, people are going to think that it's okay to do this. So I have to send you.
Well, I think everyone's sympathetic to what a tough life it is, how hard it is to make a living that way, at low wages as a waterman. But, you know, when something's done on this kind of a scale, it's hard to be sympathetic. And this went on for, what, 4 years or so?
Yeah, the scope and breadth of it is quite astounding, that it was an everyday. You had to falsify those records and send them to the Department of Natural Resources day in and day out. And it wasn't sort of a one-time temptation mistake. It was a systematic error. They called it an error in judgment. A conspiracy is the legal term for what happened. And so even though this man is clearly, an upstanding citizen in his community, He made a terrible mistake, and he committed a crime, and he pled guilty to that crime, and the judge felt that he had to send a message.
I wonder how he pays restitution. How do you pay back $500,000?
Well, $250 a month for a very long time,
yeah.
Towards
very
the restitution,
time.
And then $100 a month for the $40,000 fine. So assuming he lives a long and healthy life, probably for the rest of it, he'll be paying this fine.
Rona Cabell from the Chesapeake Bay Journal, thank you again for being here, and happy holidays to you. And
thank
happy
you,
New
you
Year.
Too.
We'll see you in January for another edition of this show. And I just want to mention again, the Chesapeake Bay Journal, you can find it online. You can also get a print edition of it mailed to your house, right?
Yes.
To your office?
Yes.
And?
And please like us on Facebook.
No. What about the subscription?
Is
it still free?
It's free. You can get a subscription at bayjournal.com. There's a button that says subscribe. But also, we're online, we blog regularly, and I post daily updates on Facebook.
Yeah, do a great job. Thank you very much, Rona.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that's our show for today. Back tomorrow with our Best Books of 2014 hour, and then the first hour, the noon hour tomorrow, you're really going to like three people doing some great things in Baltimore City that we feature in the first hour of the Friday Midday Show. We'll see you then.
Midday's senior producer is Nikki Gamer. The producer is Maureen Harvey. The associate producer is Michael Hemowitz. Our interns are Carrie DeSantis, David Richman, and Marjorie Goodman. Midday's engineers are Matt Taka and Luke Spicknell. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcast and live streaming is available at WYPR.org. Dan Roderick's column appears in the Baltimore Sun. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.